At least once a month on the program, we try to take a look at what's going on in the way of biofuels and biofuels research. And today we're going to be doing just that again with three guests for you. John Greenler, back again, Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC, at UW-Madison. With us today, John, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thank you, Larry.
Pleased to have you with us. Randy Jackson, associate professor, assistant professor, I believe. Is it assistant or associate?
Assistant.
Assistant, okay. Assistant professor in agronomy in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Randy, good to see you. Thank you for coming by.
Glad to be here.
And also with us today, Julie Sinistor, who is a PhD candidate in biological systems engineering at the UW-Madison.
Hi.
Hi, Julie. Great to have you. So you guys must all be involved in research in the biofuels area. Yeah, they're shaking their heads. Yes,
correct.
All right. Well, John, just for the way of a sort of background here before we
sure.
get going, the UW is really taking a leadership role across the country in this kind of research. And what do we have here?
Yeah, that's correct. The Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center has major funding from the Department of Energy, and it's an interesting. Collection of researchers group because it's really 10 different institutional partners that make up GLBRC, representing really kind of a number of different types of organizations, UW-Madison, Michigan State University, other academic institutions, but also some of the national labs, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, Pacific Northwest National Lab, and then we have biotech companies such as Lucigen here in town, all the way down actually to the University of Costa Rica. And so we're really interinstitutional and also very interdisciplinary. We really bring together ecologists, microbiologists, molecular biologists, economists, computer modelers to really try and take a comprehensive approach to coming up with second generation or sustainable biofuels.
And, you know, just to start things off, Julie Sinistori, is it Sinistori? Is that correct?
Yeah. I say it's Sinistori, yes.
Sinistori. Well, okay, we've got that right now. So you're a PhD candidate in biosystems engineering, and how are you involved? Is your PhD research in this area then?
Yes, I'm doing life cycle assessment modeling of lignocellulosic biofuels in Wisconsin and Michigan.
That's a mouthful. what does that mean?
So a life cycle assessment is basically taking the fuel from growing it in the field all the way through processing it into making ethanol, and in some cases all the way through the blending, distribution, and combustion in an actual engine.
Okay, so it's following the whole from one end to the other.
Right, and sort of doing a big accounting of all the energy, greenhouse gases, and any other points of interest like emissions and things like that.
Yeah, how far along are you with your research?
Oh, not very far.
not as far as you'd like to be, I'll bet.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, Randy Jackson, how about you? What's your research involved in this?
Well, our focus is in the sustainability thrust of the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and there's really six projects within the sustainability thrust, and I won't run through all of them here, but they have to do with looking at alternative production systems for cellulosic biofuels. And so we have an intensive cropping systems experiment at our Arlington Research Farm that's an exact replica of what's going on in the Michigan State side, and that's headed up by Phil Robertson and Kurt Thielen on that side. There we're looking at sort of some of the things that Julie's interested in, which is what are the energy costs to production and to harvesting this material. And then once it leaves the farm, we turn it over pretty much to the processing side of things. So our focus is really on the production of these feedstocks.
So on the production side of it. John, as we think about it, what's the most common misconception about biofuels?
Well, I think a lot of it, there's a number
there's
to be honest with you.
All right.
But I think a big one is that there's a lot of different ways of getting to a biofuel and then using that biofuel as well. And so, for example, you know, there's even a number of different types of biofuels. Clearly, I think as we've talked about before, GLBRC has its main focus on ethanol as a potential biofuel. And I think one of the things that's really important to recognize is that that ethanol can be produced from a number of different materials, biological materials, as we call them, feedstocks, and those can be produced in different ways. So, you know, what we tend to call first-generation biofuels is produced from the grain of corn, this largely a starch-based material. And what we're looking at are second-generation biofuels where we'd be using cellulosic materials, which is essentially all that kind of tough fibrous material that we associate, you know, with plant leaves and stems, even woody materials, branches, trunks, et cetera. So a lot of what might be residue from agricultural or forestry type products, there's actually a lot of energy locked up in that material. Cell walls have a lot of a material known as cellulose in them, which really cellulose is a very simple polymer compound made up of subunits of glucose, a very common sugar that is actually, you know, if you can get to the glucose, it's very easy to make ethanol from, you know, from that sugar material through a fermentation process. One of the big tricks is breaking down that cellulose to those simple sugars to then be able to go through a fermentation process.
Yeah, why is it so hard to break that down?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
So, there's a lot of reasons. Part of it is, in the name of the feedstock, you have lignocellulosic. So it's not just cellulose. You have lignin, which is super tough, super strong. It's what makes trees grow up big and tall and stand tall. Then you have hemicellulose, which is another compound that has all kinds of crazy connections, and it's all bound up together in a kind of a big tangly mess, sometimes referred to as a matrix. And you have to break those bonds and free up the cellulose without destroying the cellulose, which is a very delicate process, and you can use thermal means, heating means, chemical methods, mechanical grinding it up and things like that. But all of that takes energy, and you have to make sure you don't use too much energy. And you'd also don't want to produce other products that would inhibit the later fermentation of the cellulose.
Yeah. Well, what's the point if you spend more energy to make the product than it actually can produce itself?
Yeah. And that's actually exactly where, you know, like Julie's research, for example, doing that life cycle analysis and really doing a very good quantitative analysis to look at exactly how much energy needs to be put into such a process and how much energy can we get out to make sure that we're really, you know, working towards a product which will provide us with, you know, a significant net energy gain. So,
you know, I haven't given the phone number yet, so let me do that. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment for us today as we talk about the biofuels research with our guests, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us, too. The email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We've been, and before we go to the phones, we've been, now I'm trying to remember, has it been a little better than a year, hasn't it, that the research project has been underway here in Wisconsin, at Wisconsin?
Yep, that's correct.
What's our progress so far?
Well, I think, you know, in year one, we really have worked hard to really get the center up and running. So we went from essentially, you know, a handful of individuals to now over 300 people working in GLBRC. And at this point in time, you know, the labs are humming and the fields last year by miracle, and Randy can talk about some of that, you know, got planted, and now we're really at the point where, you know, we're beginning to get results out of the lab, and, you know, on a nice warm sunny spring day like this, you know, really looking forward to you know, the crops that were planted last year really coming up and yielding and providing us the opportunity to do some experimentation in the agricultural sector as well.
And of course, on the whole ecosystem side of things, really, many of the questions that we're interested in from a sustainability perspective are longer term. And so while we do have preliminary results rolling in on some fronts, for instance, greenhouse gas fluxes and that sort of thing during the establishment phase of these cropping systems, it's really that long-term perspective that's important. And so getting these systems in the ground last year was key. And I would say this year we should hit our stride in making a lot of the measurements that we're interested in making. I didn't have a chance to mention earlier that beyond the production side of things and the sustainability thrust, we're very keyed into both the biogeochemical and the biodiversity responses of these production systems. Mm-hmm. And so we're measuring things like carbon and nitrogen cycles, greenhouse mm-hmm. gas fluxes, microbial diversity in the soils, other types of faunal diversity, whether it's birds or arthropods. And so as you can imagine, it's a whole phalanx of ecologists and other types of researchers on the sustainability side, both at UW and Michigan State.
Absolutely. Well, that actually seems like a lot of progress to me in 1 year for 300 with 300 people up and running and on research. That's pretty good progress for 1 year. Dan in Eagle River has a question for you, so let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Yes, my question is I'm interested in the development of switchgrass as an ethanol feedstock, mainly because of the wildlife benefits. And I'm wondering how far off the commercial industry for switchgrass ethanol is. Hang up and listen.
All right. Well, that's probably a tough one to predict. John, you want to take a first? Oh, no. Well, let's turn to Julie then. Julie, said a story.
So, well, switchgrass production, we know how to grow it. To some extent, we know how to harvest it. Some of the pitfalls about it are trying to get it to a preprocessing center efficiently without, you know, using too many trucks and too much gas and things like that. So there's a lot of research into pelletizing it and making it into bricks and things like that. Then there's a lot of work going on all over the country, all over the world in preprocessing it, breaking it into cellulose. There are no commercial scale cellulosic ethanol plants.
And we'll pick that topic up with our guests in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the research going on in the biofuels area here at Wisconsin, and especially at the University of Wisconsin, but really across the country as well. John Greenler, Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, our guest, as is Randy Jackson, Assistant Professor in Agronomy in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, and also in the College of Ag and Life Sciences, Julie Sinistori, who is a PhD candidate in Biosystems Engineering. So happy to have all three of them along, and if you have some questions, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.com. Dot org. We had Dan from Eagle River had phoned and asked a question about switchgrass and when we were going to see commercial production, commercial use of switchgrass as a biofuel. Julie, I know you have some more comments or some comments about that.
Sure. So as I said, there are no currently commercial scale cellulosic ethanol plants working from any feedstock, but there are 21 pilot and demonstration scale in America using various feedstocks. The biggest roadblocks are, you know, producing the fuel cheaply, economically, and breaking down some market barriers to expand the market so that there is demand, and then, you know, working out the price in that sense. And maybe Randy can speak to that a bit more. But one of the price hurdles is the availability of affordable enzymes and things like that needed for the process.
Hmm. Yeah. Go ahead, Randy.
Certainly the focus of GLBRC is on the processing side of biomass. And so there is this bottleneck on converting cellulose into ethanol. And so when we're speaking about ethanol as a potential market, I would say that's the main limitation right now. I must say that the discussion that is going on within the center is quite optimistic that this is a reasonably tractable problem for our scientists to overcome on the processing side of things. On the production side of things, we are looking at switchgrass both as an intensively managed crop in fairly productive settings, as well as looking at it on marginal landscapes and even in CRP or Conservation Reserve Program type lands, which are soils that are inherently less productive. And yeah. So there's great interest in taking switchgrass and other types of feedstocks from these landscapes. And so we're very interested in how to do this in a sustainable way.
Yeah. And John, do you want to make a comment too?
Specifically in terms of switchgrass, I just wanted to comment that, you know, there'll be multiple uses for crop like switchgrass in terms of biofuels. GLBRC, we're focused on production of fuels for transportation, liquid fuels like ethanol. But switchgrass also has potential as a biofuel for generation of electricity or combustion for the generation of heat as well. And clearly we're looking towards that with the Charter Street plant, for example, here on the UW campus, where they're going to be converting over from the combustion of coal to biofuels. My understanding is it will largely be woody materials and also switchgrass as well. And so there'll be multiple demands for some of these biofuel-type products. And I think, you know, over time, that'll really create a kind of suite of economic opportunities for the producers as well.
I just want to add that also within the sustainability thrust of GLBRC, we have some very innovative thinkers and innovative modeling going on. And these folks are asking questions such as different emerging markets come into play, what will this mean for the production of biomass, whether it's switchgrass, hybrid poplar, corn stover, et cetera. And so there's a lot of thinking about what happens across the landscape as demand for biomass increases.
Well, I thank Dan from Eagle River for that question. And we mentioned poplar and wood came into the discussion a little bit here. And I know Don from Linden has a question relating to that, I believe. Don, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling. What is on your mind?
Well, there's a man in Linden who has about a half a dozen vehicles that appear to be powered by wood. Each one of the vehicles has a bed mounted on the back of the car. Four or five of them have literally a silver trash can sitting next to a something that looks like it might be a boiler, pipes running all the way to the front of the vehicle. Some of them are look like they're hoses you might hook your dryer to. All of them are carbureted vehicles. I'm just wondering, how could someone burn wood in a carbureted vehicle or use the gases to fuel a vehicle?
Well, you got a good question there. And John, have you heard about, have you seen these vehicles running around, John Greenler?
I wish I could say that I've actually seen such a beast out there on the highways, but unfortunately not. But, you know, I have heard similar stories of vehicles being propelled on woody materials. I think, you know, dating back, even pre-World War II, that people have designed, such mechanical contraptions. I don't think in the long run they're really going to be, a significant opportunity, just because, one of the big challenges is that wood, in terms of energy, is actually not very dense. And so, one of the main reasons to look towards something like ethanol and converting biomass like switchgrass or wood to ethanol is it's much more dense, so we're not going to have to, pull a trailer behind us or something with a huge amount of biomass. It'll go into something. Ethanol has a density, energy density, very similar to gasoline, and so the vehicles that kind of perform, within our current infrastructure system of highways and whatnot, will be able to run on biofuels without major alterations. But it's definitely possible, to make such vehicles.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Don. Appreciate it. Chris in Oshkosh, we go to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hi. A lot of the programs I hear on biofuels tend to focus on, what are the different things we can make, say, ethanol out of, and what's good about that. It's good for the environment, burns cleaner, reduces our dependency on foreign oil. And there are people, a lot of people, I think, who see that and understand those values, but unless we legislate the use of ethanol in vehicles, at the end of the day, most people aren't going to go buy a flex fuel vehicle and put E85 in it unless they see a significant price savings. So when you're making ethanol out of corn, the issue there is that if we use more and more ethanol and we heighten the demand for corn, the price is going to go up and it's going to fluctuate. And I think a lot of people aren't seeing that consistent savings, and that's maybe making people not be committed to using that as a fuel. So my question is, if either of you have any perspective on if we were able to use, say, the corn stalk or other cellulosic materials for the ethanol instead of the corn, Do we have any idea what that would produce at the pump as far as pricing? Would we see a big savings, or is that too far in the future to really gauge?
All right. Julie, you want to start?
Sure. I would say that the biggest roadblock to having cheap, affordable cellulosic ethanol right now is, again, the price of the enzymes that you need to use in order to free up the cellulose from that stock material. That stock material has cellulose, which has sugars, which can be made into ethanol, but it's not as freely available as the starch. We have enzymes now to turn starch from corn grain easily into fermentable sugars, and they're cheap and they're available, and we have lots of processes to do that. But for cellulosic feedstocks, it's not as easy. So right now, making cellulosic ethanol is fairly expensive. Now, if through efforts, perhaps through the GLBRC or other research groups, can come up with an affordable way to mass produce these enzymes, then perhaps, yeah, we could have a cheaper fuel.
So these enzymes are at the moment, they're difficult to produce or expensive to produce? Is that's the issue?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right.
Your call did not go.
Thank you very much for calling, Chris. Appreciate your call. Joel and Marinette will go to you next. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I'm calling. I have a book called Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And there's a website. It's www.alcoholscanbeagas.com. And it basically covers from everything from A to Z. On alcohol, it discusses the history, how alcohol was made, the uses. It covers a lot of the issues like the food versus fuel, all of that type of stuff. It's a really interesting book. It's 600 pages. There also is a video that's 2 hours and 40 minutes long. Can be also looked up on that site.
Alcohol Can Be a Gas.
Yes.
All right.
It's by David Bloom.
David Bloom.
Uh-huh. And a thing about that was just brought up about the use of corn for making alcohol. In the research that they have found that the corn distillers, which is left over after making the alcohol,
yeah,
is actually a better animal feed than before just feeding the corn.
Well, I don't know. Do we have some research on that? Julie, you look skeptical.
Yeah, I actually did my master's research on evaluating the energy and greenhouse gas efficiency of Wisconsin-specific produced corn ethanol, and I had to tackle the distiller's grain problem head-on, and I am not an animal scientist, but I had to read all kinds of things about it. And in terms of feeding beef animals, it's the distiller's grains is an excellent protein and fat source. They can feed large quantities of it to the beef animals. They do well. They gain weight. It's affordable. It's a little more delicate with the dairy animals, which is the main concern here in Wisconsin, because you have to carefully balance the ration to keep the cow happy and producing and healthy for as many lactation cycles as possible. So the answer to Joel's question might be sort of yes and no.
Okay.
About whether it's a better feed. Do you have anything to add, Randy?
Randy?
Well, just that we have some interest in dry distillers grains from the perspective of what happens after it's fed to the animal, and some preliminary work from a collaboration I have with some folks in Nebraska indicates that as a nitrogen source, it can be quite beneficial to helping reduce greenhouse gas fluxes from the soils and the ecosystems or the pastures where these livestock are contained. So I'm not ready to take that research to the bank yet, but this is sort of the perspective that we're looking at. Can we get a boost in productivity out of a pasture system as a result of feeding these dry distillers grains as a replacement for putting inorganic nitrogen fertilizers onto the pasture to boost productivity? And what does that mean for subsequent greenhouse gas production?
All right. And, John, have you ever seen the book Alcohols Can Be a Gas?
I haven't, but I have heard of the author, David Bloom. So, and it's been a little while, so I need to actually, I'm going to track down this book and see what it's about.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joel, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll take some more calls here. Bill in Marshfield up next. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, how you doing? Hey, this may be a silly question because I don't know much about this, but is it possible that composted material could be used as a fuel source. And if so, you could use the sun and the bacteria to break down those cellulose items and then start from there. And if it were possible, we could build big piles of this stuff and use it as a fuel source.
All right, that's an interesting idea. Julie, what about it?
Well, I'd say as a heat source, people already do that. I know from my experience in organic farming that a lot of the times you can make compost and it produces a lot of heat, and you can direct some of that heat into a greenhouse setting or a hoop house or something like that. There's also interesting gases that come off of composting materials. People do this with landfills, taking methane, gas or containing methane off of landfills and using that as a fuel. Turning it into a transportation fuel, I think, I can't think of a direct path from compost to transportation fuel.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to add, which is interesting to mention to the story of compost and biofuels, is compost piles are a natural place where you're going to find microorganisms that break down cellulosic materials and use a particular enzyme, cellulases. And so, in fact, Larry, I think you and I have talked about bioprospecting before and looking for the organisms and the corresponding enzymes in nature that do this process already. And so compost piles are a natural place to look for organisms and the corresponding compounds, enzymes that are responsible for these activities. And so, it's a great place to go looking for solutions to some of the problems we're trying to tackle.
All right.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Thanks a lot for calling. And Greg in Watertown, on to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Larry. And hi, John and folks.
Hi.
Hi,
Greg.
Hi, John. In regards to David Bloom, he's coming to Wisconsin for two workshops, one in, July 6th and 7th in the Milwaukee area, and one June 28th and 9th in the Chippewa Valley area. And I think that's partially being sponsored by the Office for Energy OEI Efficiency. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
So folks could find out about it. And I really like his perspective of energy because he comes from it from a permacultural aspect. And permaculture is sort of a principle-based methodology for how our society can exist in terms of energy and food and really interacting with itself. But that wasn't why I was calling. I wanted to remark a little bit about the fellow that called from up north running a car on wood. We have a local energy team that is doing much the same thing, except we're running generators and using it to create heat and electricity for home and farm use through gasification. And gasification is a physicochemical reaction that converts water vapor and carbon dioxide into syngas, hydrogen and carbon monoxide, which apparently has 118 octane rating. And if you can scrub the tires out of it, which is the trick, then you have a very high efficiency fuel to burn in any type of heat engine, internal combustion, external combustion, or even turbine engine. And I think it's going to be part of our energy equation because really the technology is so simple. We have a gasifier build day here at the farm every Monday afternoon. Half a dozen to a dozen folks show up and we build gasifiers and talk local sustainable energy and food systems, and it is just a great time. I'd invite anybody to come out that is interested. They could contact me through the sustainjefferson.org website.
Sustainjefferson.org.
Correct.
All right. Well, Greg, thanks very much. And Julie, let's get a comment from you on what Greg had to say.
Sure. It's funny. Just before we came here, we were talking about interesting things going on in biofuels. And I mentioned that I'm very interested in what's going to happen with syngas because it is a very versatile product that you can make from biomass, as the caller said, through gasification, which is a kind of combustion in an oxygen deficit atmosphere. And so you can make a fuel from syngas, hydrogen, you can burn carbon monoxide, that kind of thing. But you can also do things with syngas, like put it through other chemical processes and make products out of it, actual compounds similar or exactly the same as compounds we currently use in all kinds of products. I mean, everything from plastic and cosmetics and other things that we really need. That currently we get from petroleum sources, that if we want to get rid of these petroleum sources, we need another source for.
So that sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. And Tom and Mason, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just want to be very adamant what I think about these biofuels. I've ruined two chainsaws and a lawnmower about a year ago, before I finally found out I didn't see any big warning on the gas pump that you should use it, not use it, and that. And I think that the biofuels do two things. It endanger your engines, and secondly, it raises the price of the regular corn.
All right, well, let's get some comments from our guests. And I don't know, Randy, you want to start?
I can't speak to the effect that it has on chainsaws or two-cycle engines or anything like that. That's certainly outside my area of expertise. As far as what it does to the price of corn, there's some indication that the growth in corn-based ethanol has put pressure on the price of corn grain, and that's had an effect on all the uses of corn grain beyond ethanol. I would say that evidence is somewhat equivocal, so I'm not willing to hang my hat on that, but certainly there is this discussion about food versus fuel.
Well, what about ruining engines? I know there are a lot of people, for example, I have a boat, and I have a boat motor, and the guy at the marina says, now don't go putting ethanol, any percentage of ethanol in that boat motor, you're gonna ruin the motor. So I run around and try and find a gas station that sells gasoline that doesn't have ethanol in it, because it's a very expensive motor. But now, am I doing that? Is Tom right on this, Julie? Or?
So I can't speak from direct experience, but I have a friend who used to work at a motorcycle dealership, and they also did repair, and they sold ATVs. And a lot of people came in with their ATV, and they said, I let it sit for a while, I didn't use it all winter, and then I took it out, and it wouldn't start, what's wrong with it? They brought it back in, and she said that the carburetors were all gummed up, and they either had to replace them or go in with pin tools and scrape it all out. So I think it's something about letting it sit, the ethanol mixed with gasoline, letting it sit in the fuel tank. I think that one thing my friend Debbie said was, don't leave it sit. Drain it out if you're not going to use whatever the instrument is for a while, and then maybe it'll be okay. I can't speak to boats, though. I don't know much about boats.
Yeah, well, I've got a pretty expensive boat motor there. So, well, I tell you what. So Tom, there are certainly some issues around that and things that I assume are going to be addressed, Randy. Or John, rather, excuse me.
Yeah, it definitely. I know that the small motor industry is definitely, working very closely with the petroleum producers in terms of anticipating, what future formulations will look like, and the mechanics are being adopted such that those fuels won't be a problem with in the future. So.
We're certainly hoping so, and I expect that that's going to happen. And I want to thank the three of you for coming by today. The time flew by pretty fast here, as it always does. And hopefully we can have you back and do this again.
Be a pleasure.
Thank you.
Sure.
Progress going on all the time in that area. John Greenler is Director of Outreach and Education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Randy Jackson, Assistant Professor of Agronomy at the UW-Madison in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Julie Sinistori is a PhD candidate in biosystems engineering in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. And I'm sure we'll be talking some more about biofuels and biofuels research. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's the way it usually works. Coming up tomorrow on the program it's the International Year of Astronomy. So we'll be talking with Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place and Tom Hall of Eagle Optics in Middleton at 11. Then at 11:45, Glenn Bauer, a senior scientist in the UW-Madison College of Engineering, surveys the growing field of hybrid vehicles. So that's coming up tomorrow. Glenn's done a lot of work in that area, had some pretty successful teams from among his students. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.